I'm Roger Hallam. I've just been on this tour of Europe. It wasn't that big a thing, okay? So I went to Switzerland and Belgium, went up to Amsterdam, down to Paris. So I was talking to quite a lot of people, and a few themes came up. And I want to talk about these themes in the next sort of four videos. So hopefully they're going to be quite short. And I'm going to call it European Arguments, just to give it a little bit of groundedness. So, well, obviously these could be arguments anywhere around the world, but they happen to come out of this tour. And I just want to like sort of survey the landscape on what these arguments are about and give a particular take on them. Obviously, I'm talking for myself primarily, but I'm hoping that a lot of these arguments are getting won, as I would put it, around the world at the moment. And I think what they do is they basically cover these big changes that we need to change in activist culture, in radical culture, or whatever you want to call it, in order to actually get this job done, which is mass mobilization to structurally change the global economy in the next 12 months, right? I mean, that's what we're looking at now. Sounds fantastical, but that's what the science says. So we need to be like ruthlessly like analytical and risk-taking in order to get to a space where this is going to hopefully happen. So the first one, so this one, it's about money. Okay, so what can we say about money? So the issue obviously is there's all these people who are potentially going to give us money. So that covers a multitude of sins, but some of them are rich, some of them are capitalists, and some of them get money from rich people who are capitalists. Is this a problem? So that's the first part of it. And the second part of it is, if we start paying people and using this money to pay people, is that going to lead to lots of problems? Let's put it like that. So I want to sort of try and just break out of the debate. You know, these debates have been going on a long time. But I want to break out of the debate by making this really clear, decisive point, which is we're in an emergency. Right? This means we have to take these risks. An emergency means if we get it wrong, it's over. Right? We're having social collapse. We're having fascism. It's going to be beyond awful. We're returning to the worst parts of the 20th century, if we're lucky. And if we're unlucky, we're all going to go extinct. So we've got to start getting a little bit more of a grip on what's important and what isn't, what risks we can take and what risks aren't that important. So my proposition is, if we look at it from that reality, taking money, yeah, we've got to take it. And it doesn't matter that it comes from someone rich. That's just a virtue thing. You know, it's like, I don't want to be associated with these rich people. That doesn't matter. I mean, it might matter in 1990 or something, or year 2000. It doesn't matter in 2019. We need that money to grow the movement. So let's just take it. That's the fundamental point. But there's something else going on as well, which is the people that are giving the money are making a similar risk. You know, they believed in a system, and then, you know, for the sake of argument, there's all these like forest fires in California, and they're all shitting themselves. So it's not like we're dealing with some, you know, appropriating corporate capitalist routine. We're dealing with people that are crying at night the same as we are. You know, rich people don't want to die as well. Rich people care about their kids. So something fundamental is structural is changing here in the global social structure. Though all those old stories, those left-wing stories have had, well, maybe they're still correct, but there's good evidence to show that they're not, which is the climate crisis affects everyone, including these super rich people. So what does this super rich person do, right? I mean, what do we want them to do? Commit suicide and burn all their money? No. No, what we want them to do is do the decent thing, ring us up and give us that £1 million, because we need it, because money, you know, money is necessary. Okay, so now I'm going to look at the other side of the equation, which is, again, the, you know, 200-year debate, whatever. As soon as you get money, everything goes to shit because, you know, you get hierarchy and bureaucracy. and God knows what else, and it's far better to be pure and anarchistic or whatever the right word is, and you know, we have no paid people, and we're all volunteers, and we're all in solidarity with each other and all the rest of it, right? Yeah, that's very possibly true. But the fact of the matter is, we need to change the global economy in the next 12 months, right? In order to do that, some people are going to have to get paid. It's just the reality of the situation. Some people are going to have to administrate a mobilization of hundreds of thousands of people. You can't do that through voluntary activity. You know, if you try to do it, several things are going to happen. You're going to burn people out because they haven't got enough money or time to do it. Or you're not going to get all the boring stuff done because you need some people to do the boring stuff. And people aren't going to do the boring stuff day in, day out, right? You want to pay someone to do that. You need to pay someone to take the emails off, you know, to open the post. These things are all the boring stuff that requires social movements. And social movements need some people to do it. So the other point is it's not actually right anyway, right? This idea that, you know, you don't have hierarchy and all the rest of it if everyone's a volunteer. It's actually bollocks in my opinion. Because what it means is people that have got the time end up making the decisions, right? End up like doing stuff and becoming powerful. And it's no surprise that the people that have got the time are older people and middle-class people. So there's this idea of sort of egalitarian sort of paradise because no one's getting paid. It's just empirically not correct. What you'll find is these are the demographics that come to the fore. Which is fine, they're great people, you know, middle class people have their place. Obviously older people don't need money. But why are you excluding like younger people who simply cannot work full time if they can't pay the rent? Because as everyone knows, you know, there's thousands of young people who want to give up their shitty jobs and work full time for Extinction Rebellion, and they're not able to do so because they've got to do some bar job in the evening when they could be doing talks because they haven't got the cash. So let's get them the cash, right? And another demographic are mums, right? Or parents. You know, they've got kids. So who's going to pay for the childcare? Who's going to pay for the babysitter, right? Well, if you're poor, you're not going to have that money. So let's give those people some money so that they can do what they're crying out to do, which is to work full-time for Extinction Rebellion or whatever movement we're talking about, I guess, in so much as this applies to other, you know, other climate change movements. So put all those things together and, dare I say it, it's a no-brainer. We've got to take the money. It's an emergency. And that's the first and last point to be made here. It's an emergency. This is real. I know nothing like drastically horrible has happened, you know, to Western societies for the last 30 years in the wider scheme of things, but it is, you know, we're facing fascism. So let's focus on that and then do what's necessary. That's it. That's the first one. Okay, so, hi, I'm Roger from the UK. I'm doing this European argument series. Sounds a bit dramatic, but basically it's like four things that I want to talk about. And the reason I want to talk about these four things is they came up during this European tour that I did, talking to people in Amsterdam and Brussels, Paris and what have you. Wasn't any big deal, but a few common themes came out. And I think it'd be useful to sort of, as I said in the previous video, sort of quickly look at the landscape of the issue. And then I'm going to make an argument about it from an XR perspective. Obviously, it's my personal interpretation. Some people might disagree with it. That's fine. It's about creating some debate and trying to get people to think seriously about what this means in the context of the climate emergency. So the first one is about money. So this one is about centralization versus decentralization. So first thing to say about this is people have been arguing about this debate for a long time. You know, just a few people who are really organized run the show and tell everyone else what to do, sort of hierarchy centralization routine, or, you know, are you going to give it to the people and everyone decides what to do in a decentralized way without the hassle of people telling them what to do, let's say. And then from the centralized point of view, people say you can't have people just doing anything because they're going to break the rules and it's going to be disorganized and a mess. So just in case people aren't aware, people have been talking about this for a long time. So, for instance, like, I think it was 1871, there was a big bust-up between, like, Marx and the anarchists in the International Working Men's Association. It's a sort of symbolic moment in radical politics in the Western world. And it was all around this. It was like, you know, do we have a decentralized structure or do we have a central committee? So this like argument got really moralized and politicized over the decades, and you know, people end up killing each other about it. So, you know, what I want to try and introduce here is a little bit of a, let's step back from all the emotion and all the politics and actually look at it a little bit more empirically. And this is what has been done by two groups, I think, over the last 30 years, by sort of social scientists are saying, well, let's have a look at the actual dynamics. You know, how does centralization work? How does decentralization work? You know, what's the pros and the cons, and try and pan it out a bit. And then it's also been done, I would say, by what you might call practical left-wing people around the world, like people in Kerala, people in Brazil, sort of thinking, okay, so that top-down thing didn't work and that total bottom-up thing didn't work. So is there some sophistication here? And the answer, dare I say it, is yes, right? There's a sophisticated analysis that is required, and there's some nuance that's required in terms of actually designing what actually works, which gets you the best of both worlds. You're organized and you don't have the worst of hierarchy, as it were, you know, domination of some people telling other people what to do and all the rest of it. All right, so the first thing to say is there's some fundamental point here, which is any group of people have to decide who decides. So this is like an old political theory point, as you might say. And if you don't have a group of people who decide stuff, then someone will decide anyway. So this is what is being called the structure of, what's it called? The tyranny of structurelessness, right? Which is feminists came up with in America in the early 1970s. So it goes a bit like this, is if you haven't got a way of making decisions, then you can't decide how to decide. And then if you can't decide how to decide, you can't decide how to decide how to decide. And then you can't decide how to decide how to decide how to decide. So you go down this warren, right? So this might sound like slightly amusing, but it's catastrophic for a network, because at a certain point, like, nothing can happen. You just get clogged. Because let's say, I'll give you an example, you know. Let's say I want to suggest that the international rebellion is on the 7th of October. So you could come to me and say, hang on, Roger, you know, how come you're deciding? You know, what's so special about you? And then you could say, well, I'm going to set up this process through which you can decide it. And then someone else could come along to you and say, hang on a minute, what gives you the right to decide how to decide this process? You know, who's given you the authority to make decision? You're just some, you know, Eurocentric white whatever, right, people. You know, what about us? And then they try to decide how to decide how to decide, and then they get challenged. So it's a nightmare. You see how this works? So the fact of the matter is there's some decisions that have to be made by the whole group because they affect the whole group. If you want to go and have a picnic, right, no one's bothered, right? It doesn't affect me, so I'm not bothered about that decision. But if you want to, you know, decide that we want to drive on the right-hand side of the road, that affects everyone. So everyone has to be involved in it. And then you have to have a way to decide whether to drive on the right-hand side of the road or the left-hand side of the road, right? So this is a metaphysical thing. It's not a political thing. It's like sometimes there's all group decisions. Like, if you want to have a rebellion on the 7th of October, that affects everyone. It means people, you know, in South Africa or Los Angeles or London, everyone has to now go on the 7th of October, right? Well, that affects everyone. So how do you decide it? Well, so this is the role of centralization. You have to have a group that makes that decision. Now, they can make it in a sophisticated way, but the bottom line is you have to have a group that decides. Or, in so much as you haven't got that, you have to have a group that decides how to decide. And you just have to do it. And it's a bit of a ruthless thing, if the truth be known. But if you don't have it, then you either never make any decisions, i.e. there's never a rebellion organised, which is a total disaster from a climate emergency point of view, or it's just chaotic, you know, or someone decides anyway, which isn't great. So the idea of trying to avoid hierarchy just pushes that hierarchy under the ground. In other words, someone just decides, you know, in a covert way. which was the point of the tyranny of structurelessness. You create a tyranny of a few people making decisions without any authority, without any transparency. So the solution is to have some sort of constitutional arrangement, and this has been done, you know, by various radical communities right down history. There's still rules about how to decide things. Okay, so this is the second issue. Here's the proposition. Unless you have a really centralized structure, you can't effectively decentralize. Okay? So again, this is a nuanced point. It's not like decentralized structure forever or some extreme hierarchy. All we're saying is you have to have some guys at the center organizing the decentralization. Otherwise, the people that decentralized, number one, don't really know what to do, and number two, don't know what's happening because they don't have any structure. So what the guys at the center need to do is to design the decentralized structure so people know how to do decentralization properly. So I'll give you a little example, like with the London XR meetings before last Christmas, there were 150 people coming to meetings. It was all great. They all wanted to decentralize, but they couldn't do it because no one was organizing it. So what I said to people is, I want people to work full time in the London office and we're going to organize it. So after a month or two of getting ourselves organized as a centralized organization, we said, right, here's D-Day. We're going to do talks in the 32 boroughs of London. So over like 4 or 5 weeks, we set up 20 groups in London, right? After the rebellion in April, we disband these centralized meetings because we've got vigorous, robust, decentralized groups around London that have been set up. They've got a coordinator. They've been received training. They know how to run meetings. They know what their mandate is, what to do, and they're confident, right? But you can't organize that unless someone's organizing it. And whoever's organizing it has to do that centrally, at least initially, right? Once they've been set up, obviously, those groups can train other groups. So this is the point is, initially, you have to have centralization. And this is the same thing with how XR started. XR didn't start with loads of people, like, you know, all coming together arguing. It was 15 people saying, this is what is required in order to have a decentralized movement. So we were a centralized group that was required to create this decentralized movement. We didn't say, this is what we think and all these other ideas have come. We said, this is what we think. If you don't agree with us, that's cool. You're going to set up your own social movement. But this is what we think and this is how we're going to do it. So, you know, this is a paradox, isn't it? You know, this is when you actually get to, you know, to the actuality of organizing things, these are the main issues you have to deal with. It's not some high moral politics about, you know, hierarchy or whatever. It's about actually getting a job done and empowering people in actuality. So, okay, so that's cool. So you've got your structure, you've got your, you know, you've got your anchor circle, whatever, that makes the decisions that affect everyone. That's cool. You've got your secretariat, as it were. You've got your central group who are facilitating this decentralization. And obviously you need to make sure that they do that job and they don't, you know, they don't not create decentralization. So that's a risk. But, you know, they should be able to do that. And then in the longer term, the next idea is mandates. So I'm not going to talk loads about holacracy and self-organizing systems because that's not really my, you know, specialism. I just want to make the simple point that if you want to effectively decentralize, the most effective way to do it is to create mandates, so that people know what they have the power to do within their groups. And this overcomes structurelessness. If you have chaotic decentralization, as it were, no one knows what's going on because no one knows what to do because no one knows what you're supposed to be doing. So you need some sort of mechanism whereby you can give different decentralized groups a mandate. But that requires centralization because guess what? Someone has to decide who gets what mandate. How do you do that? Well, you need to have a group. Otherwise, you're going to have the who decides problem. So again, that group that gives the mandates has to be transparent, has to be trained. The membership has to rotate, all these sort of constructive things to make sure it doesn't become some consolidated hierarchy. But at the end of the day, if someone's not dishing out mandates, then no one knows what to do. So that's the sophisticated, you know, analysis, that we're not looking at some centralization versus decentralization. What modern scholarship shows is that you can have both, or rather you need both. You certainly need centralization to start off with in order to create these structures. And then you have this sophistication that holacracy and sociocracy show, and as I say, I'm not going into the details, but they show that you need to have this sophisticated structure around people having mandates, and that's transparent and all the rest of it. So hopefully that's what, you know, all these groups are going to get on with. Okay, so yeah, in case you're not aware, my name's Roger, and I'm doing this little European arguments sort of series. Done one on the money issue, taking money. Just done one on centralisation, decentralisation. And this one is about going to the people. I'm calling it that. This has come out of doing these talks around Europe that I've just come back from, and some of the discussions I've had. And dare I say, it's probably the most important one. I mean, they're all important, okay? But if I had to choose one, this might be it. Might change my mind. But anyway, so why is this the most important one? Okay, so I was going around Europe, you know, went to Amsterdam, went to Brussels, went to Paris, you know, 200 people, whatever. And they all come in. And what I notice immediately is, well, they're all great people, right? Let me say that, right? You can tell they're great people. They're really animated. They're really serious. But also from only one, broadly speaking, only one cultural group, which is urban, educated, liberal stroke radical, okay? Very competent, fantastic. But there's a big problem, which is, with all due respect, they are not the demographic that are going to transform the global economy, okay? The demographic that's going to change them is the common people, okay? That's not a very exact phrase, so I'm going to come on to that in a minute. But let's just put that out there. So what am I talking about here? What I'm talking about is what in the political literature is called the paradox of political identity. And it's the single biggest problem in social movement building. And arguably, it's the, or at least a central problem in the whole of politics. And it goes a bit like this, which is, you know, crap things are happening, so you want to do something about it. So what you do is you go to a meeting and there's other people like you there because, you know, there's people from a similar demographic that are worried about it, like, let's say, educated urban people. Not all of them, but let's say 1% of them. So that's great. So you have your meeting, everyone's sort of like you, you get on, you've been to the same university, you like the same music, you know, you have the same sort of cultural attitudes. Fantastic. You're all mates, you want to go again. So you're going again the following week, and it gets bigger. And it builds up to, say, 100 people, and it's fantastic. And you're all the same. And the reason it builds so fast is because everyone's culturally similar. You talk in a similar way, have the same sort of etiquette. You know, this isn't just about politics. It's deeper than that. But obviously, everyone's, let's say, broadly left-wing and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So that's great. But the paradox is the extent to which you're successful through building a social movement, through getting everyone like me to join it, you are unsuccessful in taking it to the next stage. Because at a certain point, you're going to run out of urban, sensible, educated people. And that's it. You're going to stay there. And you're not going to get onto the other demographics. But it's worse than that. It's when the other demographics come into that space, they immediately feel alienated. So this can apply to sort of, you know, people of colour or whatever, you know, marginalised people within the city, working class people, they're going to come in and go, hang on a minute, this isn't for me. And let me emphasise, this is not because people are being unpleasant or racist or whatever, you know, let's hope not anyway. It's just because they're different. And we're all like herd animals in that sense, that we love to be with people that we like. And then, so it's those guys. And then also, you might go out to, you know, rural Belgium, let's say, and go to a farming town. And those people don't want to join you because, you know, they think it's just those urban types. So you've got a geographical problem and you've got a class problem. The two things combined. So that's the paradox is of political identity. Is political identity is great for getting going, and it's a disaster for actually getting to scale. So the biggest reason why Extinction Rebellion has been successful in the UK, where it's a lot bigger than everywhere else, and this is my central point, is that we decided to go to the people first rather than just being buddy with all our mates in urban liberal circles, let's say, or radical circles. So that had an actual concrete implication, which was we organised public meetings in village halls, town halls, small towns, you know, rural areas, and told people the standard talk, which is we're fucked, we need to do civil disobedience, break the law, and there's a pathway to action, which is to come down to London and sit in the road. So it had those three elements to it, which optimised mobilisation. People know that the truth is there, you know, which is terrible. So they've got tears in their eyes because, oh my God, you know, I never realised it was so bad. Number two, you show them like what has to be done about it, i.e. you have to have mass civil disobedience to get this job done quickly. And third, you know, next Thursday, there's a non-violent direct action training and off we go, you know, form an affinity group, go and break the law. So the next point I want to make, and this is a really profound point, which is, and I've said this in the other talks about the money, is the whole social, psychological, emotional structure of the Western democratic world is being transformed, and arguably all around the world. But obviously I'm focusing on Europe, and there's implications obviously for Australia and the United States. But it goes a bit like this, is initially we just thought that there was only a small demographic that were concerned about climate change, you know, because it was like an environmental issue, you know, it's about polar bears, it's about looking after the planet, you know, it's a typical issue, right? That's not the case anymore. We're now in this climate emergency. So this has transformed the potentiality for mass movement building. In other words, like, farmers are not going to be able to farm in 10 years' time, right? That wasn't the case 30 years ago. Just trundle along and everything would be fine. But now that's an objective truth, right? I mean, it might be 5 years, it might be 15, but it's coming down the tracks, right? So that's a fact. That's the first thing. And the second thing is farmers aren't idiots, right? A lot of them know this, but they don't know what to do. So they're like, they're a massive resource for mobilisation. But all these urban political people are going, well, for 30 years, farmers, you know, didn't care about our issues, so what's the point of going to the farmers? Incorrect analysis. The correct analysis now is they're ready to be mobilised, right? So the UK has proved this. We went to these rural communities and what have you, and got farmers involved. We've got, you know, people that have never heard about the Green Movement, never heard about, like, the North Pole, right? They don't really even care about it. What they care about is the universal message, which is they're going to lose their livelihoods, they're going to lose their businesses, they're going to lose their communities, and their children are going to starve to death, right? This is what's coming down the line. Now, that is a universal message. So this is like the big sort of penny drops moment is, number one, if we're not going to get a mass movement, we're not going to get anywhere. So you're going to have to go to these guys anyway, because you're not going to fill it all up with liberal middle-class people, because as everyone knows, like, yeah, 1% of liberal middle-class people, radical middle-class people do stuff, but we also know loads of them just don't care because they've got too much skin in the game, and you know how it is. So what we need to do is go and mobilise the 1% of normal people, which actually happens to be a far bigger demographic because you're talking about the whole country. So let's say there's 10,000 people in London that get it, but you can estimate that there's probably 100,000 people around the country who were ready to get it. I mean, there's still like 55 million people that aren't, but this is the next demographic to go to. Okay, so I want to be a little bit more specific about it, to give it a bit more concreteness, is that the idea I want to put forward is, yeah, so the urban, you know, radicals and what have you, we're mobilising them. But there's this other group, and I want to be, it's not so much the common people, though obviously it is everyone, because it's a universal message. But the other major demographic to mobilise is the rural poor, or the rural lower middle class, if you want to be technical about it. These are people that have enough time to think about what's happening in the world, but and know, potentially know anyway, that it's over for them because there's not going to be no farming in the next 10 years and all the rest of it. So an example of this is, you know, I went to talk to some people in Turkey, right there in Istanbul, great guys, totally into it, but we were... After talking for about half an hour, I think everyone realised that the people that are suffering most from climate change are small farmers in eastern Turkey, where there's been a drought for 10 years. So you've got this interesting thing where you've got two completely different demographics and never talk to each other historically, you know, for good reasons, because they don't really like each other and haven't got much to say, suddenly find some objective connectivity. And that's what needs to be brought together through these talks. And I'll give a little bit example of this, like from the UK. is another sort of demographic is, you know, small towns where not much is going on. And as people probably know, is small towns, people in small towns are moving to the political right because they feel left behind. So they're already what you might call alienated from the system. But if you go there and do talks, you find a lot more of them are willing to break the law and go to prison and what have you, because there's not that much going on in their lives. So I can give you a few like figures here. Is if I go to sort of Brighton or London or whatever, and I do a talk and I say afterwards, you know, how many people want to get arrested to go to prison, they might find like 5 to 10%. If I go to like, you know, let's call it a depressed, you know, English town like Scunthorpe or Sunderland, or go to Wales to Carmarthen or something like that, then I find it's about 30%. So that's a bit of hard, you know, data there. And why is that? It's not because people are green or radical or right on or culturally acceptable. It's because they care about their kids and they haven't actually got that much going on in terms of skin in the game. So they're more prepared to go out into rebellion. So we're missing this massive trick here. And I want to say something. This might go on to 20 minutes. Hopefully that'll be all right. I want to say something about specifically how to do it. Because I talk to people, you know, a lot about this, and I talk to people, you know, in Brussels and what have you, and they're going, yeah, that's cool. You know, they get it. But then, you know, the big sort of, there's a big fear barrier, which is you go to some rural town in southern, you know, Belgium. I mean, how exactly do you do this? Which is a good question. You know, you don't just turn up and knock on the door of some community centre and say, hey, I'm doing this talk. But in actuality, that's sort of what you have to do. So there's a number of different ways. So I'm going to briefly go through them, and you know, you're going to have to try a few different ways. I mean, obviously you've got a database, so you could send an email out to all the people in that rural area, maybe within 20 square miles, and say, I want to do a talk in the town. Can you find me a community centre or a church? And so I can come along and do it. And could you publicise it a bit, you know, put posters up or something like that? So they'll do that for you. You just need to find one or two people in the region that will do it. Or the worst comes to worst, you could just go and do it yourself. And then you do a talk, right? So don't expect anything dramatic. Maybe only 5 people turn up. I mean, maybe more, so that's great. But let's say only 5 people turn up. It's not the end of the world, because those are your 5 local people. And then what you do is you headhunt, as it were, the 2 that have got their head screwed on, and they're going to be most likely embedded in that community, right? And you say to those people, look, you know, we didn't get many people here tonight, but we want to do it again in a fortnight. Could you, you know, spread it through your social media or through your offline mechanism, you know, ways, because they're embedded in the local networks. And, you know, 5 times out of 10, you know, the next time you do it, you're going to have 20 people there. And then you headhunt your coordinators, and then you get out of the space, you know, you train them and what have you, and then they're on the go. And they're going to then promote it, you know, according to their cultural references, you know, about what's happening with farming, what's happening to rural communities, you know, what's happening to rural incomes, what's happening when, you know, there's no food and all the rest of it. So, and then you're on the go. So it's not a matter of sort of just strolling up and suddenly hundreds of people turn up. You're going to have to work on it a bit. But the main thing is just do it, because through your failure, you'll actually work out how to succeed. So you might, you know, you might only get 2 people. It doesn't matter. You know, you'll get some data and you think, okay, I'll do it again and we'll do it slightly differently. And obviously, once you've got the local people involved, then they do it themselves, because then it's like people like me, you know, because if I did it, they're going to think, you know, who's that person? Well, if it's Mrs. Jones from down the road, you're going to, oh, right, you know, this is. And as my tour showed, lots of normal people are really animated about this. So because it's this universal issue. So I want to finish on this fundamental structural point, which is it's a numbers game, right? So even if, you know, you don't really like this idea, let's say, and you don't really want to do it. No, you've got to do it, because all those urban people are going to starve to death if you don't get the numbers on the street. In other words, if you don't sort this crisis out. So how do we do that? By getting thousands of people. What's the quickest way of getting thousands of people? Build a mass movement. What's the quickest way of building a mass movement is stop being snotty about people who aren't like you. Go out and talk to people you don't particularly like, don't particularly connect with. And dare I say it, it will enrich your life, you know, because as I'm sure many people know, when you start mixing with people who aren't like you, you'll learn a lot about the world. So, you know, there's a personal aspect to it as well. But the end of the day It's a numbers game. You need thousands of people on the streets of Brussels, Amsterdam, Paris, and this is how you're going to get it done. So just do it. So, yep, Roger here. This is my fourth little mini video on European arguments. And been talking about a lot of different things. And on this one, I'm going to be talking about talking to the police. This is a big issue. It's a really sensitive issue. And it is difficult to deal with because there's lots of emotions and strong feelings and views involved. So I want to acknowledge that before I start. And what I also want to say is everything I'm going to say in the next 10, 15 minutes is not telling anyone what to do, right? What I'm going to do is produce some evidence and make an argument. If you don't like that argument, that's fine. You don't need to deal with it. But that's all I'm doing. I'm putting forward a point of view, and anyone watching it has to decide what to do. So it's not like you must go and talk to police. You must put yourself in harm's way. You must put yourself in catastrophic harm's way, right? I mean, that's your decision. I'm making an argument about what's effective in terms of building a mass social movement in order to stop our children from starving. That's where I'm coming from. So it's important, and this is a big sort of meta point, I suppose, is if we're going to be successful, we need to be able to freely deliberate on things which are difficult to work out whether they're actually working or not. And maybe they are, maybe they're not. But we're not going to work that out unless we look at evidence and we argue over it, as you might say, in a sort of data-driven sort of way. So it's not like this is the religious, political, dogmatic view, and that's the end of the argument. Those days have gone, right? We can't afford the luxury of dogma. We need to be looking at what actually works, or rather, what could work or might work. You know, we never know. So just leading on from this point, there's a related point, which is I'm not making a moral argument. I'm not interested, in terms of my analysis, of trying to decide or argue over whether the police are racist, whether they're violent, whether they're fascist or whatever, like whether they're bad people. What I'm interested in is this mobilisation situation. In other words, what's effective? And obviously, the police can and do often act in terrible ways. The point of this video is not arguing about that. It's not arguing about what the police are like. It's making a point about how to maximise mobilisation, okay? And the moral, if you want a moral argument for mobilisation, the whole point of Extinction Rebellion is to be strategic, to think about what brings about mass mobilisation. Because what the data has shown over the last 100 years is you can't change anything unless you have a mass movement. That's the fundamental point of Extinction Rebellion. So what the question is, how do we actually get to that point? Okay. So I'm going to give you a plan, all right, about how to deal with the police. So I'm going to describe it first, and then I'm going to give an argument about why it works, and then give a few examples, you know, evidence, as it were. But my proposal is that you talk to the police. And I don't just mean talk to the police in a nice country, in inverted commas, like Britain. In principle, I'm in favour of talking to the police in any situation, right? I mean, we can argue about super extreme situations, but let's say, for the sake of argument, definitely in France, America, you know, around the Western world. That's what I'm primarily talking about. But arguably, you can talk about this in the Global South as well. So I want to make a specific proposal, particularly for the European countries, that you do the following, and the US, around the Western world, okay? Which is, when you've got an action, or rather, before you organise any actions, you phone the police up and you say, hello, we're Extinction Rebellion. We're a peaceful, non-violent movement that is protesting about the climate crisis that affects everybody. We would like to come and talk to you about our movement and about what we intend to do. So you get an appointment with them, you go in the door, and for 15 minutes, you tell them about the climate crisis and then about your methodology of change, which is, we will be breaking the law, okay? And the thing that you want to emphasise in this communication is two things. That we're a peaceful, non-violent movement, right? We don't believe in violence and we're disciplined. You can rely on us to remain non-violent. Secondly, we respect you have to do your job, okay? So this might sound a little bit controversial, But respecting doesn't mean you necessarily agree. It just means we respect that from your point of view, you have to do your job here. Your job, as you understand it, is public order and maintaining the law. And what that means is if someone's breaking the law, then you're going to arrest someone and potentially you're going to go to prison. So our message to you is, that's fine. We understand that's what you have to do. And we're coming to you to say that we are not going to resist arrest, right? We're not going to be running down the street with you chasing us. If you want to arrest people, that's fine, okay? So my second proposition is that when you're actually in the field, as it were, and you're sitting in the road or whatever's happening, and the police come up, you have a police liaison person. And the police liaison person goes up to the police and does the following two things, which is the same thing, which is to say, I'm here to let you know that this protest today is a peaceful, non-violent protest. It's not going to be violent. It's not going to be aggressive. We are simply peacefully sitting on the road or whatever you're doing. Secondly, I want to say to you that we totally respect that you have to do your job here. If you want to arrest the people sitting in the road today, that's totally fine. You know, if you want to ask any questions about it, I'm available to communicate to you about this. I'm not in charge. No, I'm simply here to communicate what's happening. And if I can help you anyway, that's fine. And then you might want to go away for 5 minutes and come back and then, you know, ask who's in charge, as it were. And they'll, of course, be asking who's in charge. And you'll say, you know, no one's in charge, but you can talk to me, and variations on the theme. So note, like, this is not giving away any technical information, obviously not giving anyone's names or anything silly like that. What you're doing is establishing, like, some protocols of interaction, as you might say, how they're going to treat you and what they can expect from you. This is useful. The police like to know what they're dealing with, and you're helping them with that process. Okay, so obviously we can embellish on that, but you know, this is a short video. But that's when I say talking to the police, that's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about talking to the police to ask permission about blocking road. When you go and see the police, you're saying, we're going to be blocking the road, right? But what you're doing is going to tell them this information. You're not telling them about all your plans. You're telling them that it's a peaceful protest, and if they want to arrest you, that's fine. Okay. So there's three reasons actually, why this actually works, or at least could work, or you might say should work. Okay. So again, you know, never say never. You know, there's always a possibility they're all going to come down on you like a ton of bricks. But there's three specific reasons. So the first one is it humanizes the relationship. And, you know, a lot of left-wing people and a lot of right-wing people have a very materialistic idea about political dynamics. It's a bit like they've got that interest, we've got this, bang, we have this confrontation, right? You know, it's very sort of Marxist, or, you know, there's lots of right-wing people think the same thing. You know, the world is basically a battle between different forces. Well, you know, there's a lot going for that point of view. I'm not disputing that for a minute. But there's something else, and that's human contact. And human contact, arguably, and very often, trumps economic interest. So what I mean by that is, if you go and see the police, and you're talking to the head officer for the sake of argument, when you've talked to him about this, then inevitably you're going to start having some small talk, right? And, you know, if you're a reasonably sociable person, you're going to end up talking about your kids and the weather and all the rest of it. And you might think, you know, from a reductive point of view, you might say, well, that's all irrelevant. But it's not. There's plenty of research that shows that if people treat each other decently and professionally and respectfully, then it's very difficult to hate them. It's a bit like, well, you know, I'm not sure about these protesters, but, you know, it's sort of interesting they came to talk to us. And that means that you start opening up this relationship whereby you can come to some sort of understanding. And the understanding is that this protest is going to be nonviolent. So that's important for the police that they understand that. And secondly, that you're not like against the police, you know, in terms of this action. I mean, the important thing to realise here is you can hate the police as much as you like or think they're terrible. That's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is behaviour and speech. What you actually say to them and how you act towards them, right? You can have your particular attitudes. That's neither here nor there. What we're talking about is practice, as you might say. So that's the humanisation side of it. So the next thing is predictability. Like, particularly in the Western world, police forces are professional. That doesn't mean that they're always professional, but what it means is they're primarily concerned with what you might call a protocol-led approach. They have rules about how to act. And I said, you know, if you're the wrong, you know, if your skin's the wrong color and you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, then you don't, that might not be the case. But the fact of the matter is they're not a mob, right? They have a hierarchy, they have rules, and one of the biggest rules is this situation we're dealing with predictable or not? If it's not predictable, then we cannot afford to let anything tricky happen. They're responsible for public order. So if they're going to have a demonstration and they have some intelligence that it could go into a riot, right, they will bring the riot police, even if there's only a 5% chance, because they can't afford for that not to happen. Now, if you're dealing with Extinction Rebellion or an Extinction Rebellion-esque operation, and you go and say, look, we'll be blocking this road for 10 minutes and then we're going to get off, right? If you do that like 3 or 4 times and you follow those rules, in other words, you do what you'll say you're going to do, they're not stupid. They're going to start going, well, that's Extinction Rebellion. And if they say they're staying on the road for 10 minutes, then they're probably going to do it, which means we don't have to overreact, right? We don't have to send like 300 police to have like, you know, 20 old age pensioners in Vienna sitting in the road for like 10 minutes. They do if they think they're going to be there for 2 hours. But if they know they're only going to be there for 10 minutes, then they'll just send like 5, right? And they might not even arrest you because it's a palaver, right? So the more that you can create this trust through humanization, and the more they can actually empirically analyze that you do what you say you're going to do, then they're less likely to overreact. Again, never say never, but they're less likely, right? This is all about probabilities, which leads us on to like an even more fundamental thing, which is cost, right? The fact of the matter is, being brutal and over-policing and using riot police and all the rest of it costs loads of money, right? And this is what the Metropolitan Police have sorted out in London. Everyone thinks the Metropolitan Police in London are like, you know, sort of, you know, civilised British people. Well, maybe, maybe not, right? But what we do know for certain is they've got a very small budget, right? They'd love to have a bigger budget. And when you've got a small budget, everyone knows you have to cut costs. And the best way of cutting costs is not to have to over-police, right? So if they know that it's super peaceful and it's going to be, you know, old people sitting in the road or whatever it's going to be, they're going to, number one, decide not to arrest people, because arresting people costs money. Or if they do decide to arrest people, why do they want to go to the costly extreme of having, you know, a whole load of police violence and riot police and all the rest of it? You know, it doesn't make any sense. You know, you've only got a certain amount of money, so you want to spend it wisely. So those combinations enable you to do civil disobedience and not have an overreaction from the police. Which brings me on to the strategic point here, which is if we're going to build a civil resistance movement through civil disobedience, we need lots of people. If you go out on day one and start shouting at the police and wearing hoods and all the rest of it, the police are going to come down on you like a ton of bricks, right? Everyone knows that. That's not going to encourage, you know, Mrs. Jones, you know, 60-year-old lady from, you know, some rural French town to come up to Paris. She's going to think, hang on a minute, you know, sure, I'm willing to sit in the road, but I don't want to sit in the road and get my, you know, head beaten up. While if she knows she's coming up to Paris to basically sit in the road, and it's happened 2 or 3 times before and she's seen it on video and people are like basically like just dragged off, she think, yeah, I can cope with that, you know, so what? So what we need to strategically design is a low police response combined with civil disobedience in order to get to the critical mass, which is several thousand people sitting on the road to Paris or Brussels. How are we going to do that? Is by getting the police, of course, to behave themselves. How do you do that? Through humanization, through providing predictability, and through like enabling them to police Extinction Rebellion events at low cost. So you can see this has nothing to do like some grand ideology about the fascist police or the ruling class or whatever, right? You know, maybe, maybe not, right? This is about concrete empirical observation of dealing with the police over the last 2 years in the UK. So I've been to dozens of meetings, yeah, a lot of meetings with the police, and that enables me to collect intelligence. And obviously they're collecting intelligence about me, which brings us on to the final point, which is design civil disobedience so it doesn't matter that the police know about it, right? You can design things where it's got to be secret, which is great, but if it's secret, you're going to provoke a big police response. And also, people don't know about it, so you can't do mass civil disobedience. So what you want to organise is with the police, as it were, so the police know, so you can go and see the police afterward. This is the golden rule. Go and see the police and actually tell them. And if that fundamentally undermines the action, then redesign it. So, for instance, you know, let's say you're in New York, you know, and you say, look, you know, at some point during 7th of October, 500 people are going to sit in the road. You know, I'm not going to tell you where and when particularly, because you don't really need to know that, but they're going to be sitting in the road, and, you know, then you can come and arrest them. So the police already know, and you can make it public. You know, you can have an assembly point or whatever, so thousands of people know where to go. And this is like the sort of genius, as it were, of the XR system, which is if you get lots of people, then obviously the police aren't going to stop it. It's too many people. So by being open, you get the best of both worlds. You get lots of people and the police can't stop it. If you're secretive, you're not going to get many people and then the police might stop it. So it's like a downward spiral rather than an upward spiral, if you see what I mean. So this isn't, you know, this is nothing to do with being nice to the police. And if you look at the literature, you know, of the global south, you know, civil disobedience, civil resistance, people consciously, like, interact with the police. And this is my final point. Did I make a final point? Which is, how is this going to happen? How are we going to get structural change in our societies? There's a simple answer. When the police stop arresting people, the state and the elites are only powerful to the extent that the security forces do what they say. And as we should all know, a lot of police officers on the front line are really pissed off with the elites in the government, you know, because of austerity and 101 other reasons. So if they get the idea that they can, you know, go slow or make a statement saying they're not going to arrest you anymore, that's the primary objective. So subverting the police is it's not a hippie thing, right? It's solid strategic thinking, which is why in these authoritarian regimes, people go up to the police and, you know, put flowers in their guns and all the rest of it. It's not because they're being nice, because they're smart. Once those people stop shooting, then you've got the downfall of the regime. And, you know, if you want a stat on this, I think Erica Chenoweth's research shows if you can subvert the police and the security forces, you're 60% more likely to bring down a regime. So, you know, whether or not we're bringing down regimes, that's not really the issue here. The issue is when the police say, hang on a minute, we're not, you know, arresting grannies 5 days in a row. That's not what we signed up for. They go to the politician and say, you've got to sort this out. You've got to go to the negotiation table. And then when we get to the negotiation table, that's when we get real change. So, you know, this isn't just a surfacey, you know, minor issue. This is central to XR strategy. And yeah, it might not always work. You might not agree with it, but that's what we're doing. And it's starting to happen all around the world. And dare I say it works.